I'm Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor of Penn State Barron, and you are listening to Barron Talks. Today, my guest is Dr. Eric Cordy. Eric is the director of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences.
Correct.
But he's also a professor of psychology. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you very much, Ralph.
I'm going to run through a little bit of your bio here and hopefully embarrass you a little bit with your accomplishments. But you hold a doctorate in clinical psychology from Indiana University, bachelor's degree from Vassar College, which I know well from having lived in that area for a while. Maybe I don't know it too well, but I know where it's at. Well-respected school. You were a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and at Case Western University School of Medicine. You taught at the University of Maryland and Bradley University before you came here to Penn State Barron in 1993. Now, a little bit more. Your work in the classroom has been recognized for excellence both at Barron and across the university. Not only have you won our Council of Fellows Excellence in Teaching Award, but you were later selected and served as a Penn State Teaching Fellow, and we're going to dig into that a little later. You were appointed director of the School of Humanities officially in 2017, but you started in 2015 on an interim basis, and you're going to retire after 29 years this summer. So this is a little bit of a farewell conversation. Anyways, again, welcome, Eric.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk a bit about your background, how it shaped you and your career as a professor and administrator. So why did you ever decide you were going to study and research psychology?
I actually didn't plan to study psychology initially. I picked my college, Vassar, because it offered Chinese. I was interested in studying Chinese. I was a table tennis player, and Nixon just opened China via table tennis diplomacy. I wanted to kind of get involved in that. So I went to Vassar, went to Chinese class. On the first day, learned Chinese as a melodic language. And I am tone deaf.
Yeah.
You say something rising or falling tone, it makes a difference. I couldn't tell the difference. And within a couple of days, I dropped Chinese. Had to pick up another course. And I remember talking to my mom over the summer about what I was taking that fall. She said, Eric, why don't you take psychology? I think you understand people well. So I dropped Chinese, picked up psych, and got an A in psych my first semester, B's and everything else. Figured psych is easy.
That
was the way to go.
It's not easy, though.
No, it's not easy.
And your parents were academics.
My father's a PhD from Michigan and undergraduate MIT, but he's a DuPont Chemical Company. Mother, an undergraduate degree from Radcliffe and a master's from Yale. She's a journalist. Distinguished line of scholars.
Well, they truly influenced which way you were going. And, well, we're happy that you ended up here at Barron, but I always like to hear, you know, what's the path that you took? How did you end up here at Penn State Barron?
It wasn't a direct path. I met my wife. We got married in 1985. I was working in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on a methadone research project that's based in Baltimore, Maryland, and originally based in Philadelphia and moved to Baltimore. So I lived in Baltimore for a while when we were first married. In fact, we've been married for 35, 37 years. We've never both been gainfully employed in the same state, let alone, so.
Well, congratulations, first of all, on, what did you say, 37 years?
37 years.
37 years.
Yeah. But I wanted to go into academia. I finished my first postdoc and took a job at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. Sarah quit her job, moved with me to Peoria, and discovered there's not much for her to do there. So she got her PhD at Illinois State and took a job at Case Western. I quit my tenure-track job at Bradley, moved to Cleveland with her to do my second postdoc. In the second year of that postdoc, there's an open here for a one-year position, non-tenure-track, sabbatical replacement. I applied, I took the job, and 29 years later, here I am.
Yeah. Worked out well.
It worked out well.
Now, you've commuted then for, so you live in Cleveland, right? You and your wife raised your children there.
Yes. I commuted for a number of years. I became chair of the psychology program. We moved here, lived here for 4 years. And one of my sabbaticals, we moved back to Cleveland. And now I have an apartment here. I couldn't do the job of being director without living here.
Sure. Eric, let's talk about your research. You look in the field of psychology in a field called psychometrics, which is the development of measurable psychological variables. Tell us what that's all about.
Measurement is the most important part of science. If you can't measure something, your knowledge is pretty thin. And so, for example, we're trying to study how to reduce fevers or illness in people. If all we have is asking people, do you feel hot? That's not a very good measurement. Putting a hand on the forehead is maybe a little bit better, more objective. Mm-hmm. But thermometers allow us to measure more accurately. And so if you're going to measure fevers, thermometers are an objective way to measure that. Psychological variables, depression or anxiety or sexual function, we rely on people's self-report. And to develop a good measure of that is hard to do. So psychological variables are very hard to measure because they're usually constructs, things we can't observe directly. Mm-hmm. Gravity is a construct. We measure gravity indirectly by how things fall to the floor. And so psychometrics is the science of measurement. It's the basis. I tell my students it's the most important class in psychology they'll ever take.
I think it is because it's so difficult. And as you said, it points to the fact that it's a science. We call it a social science. And you have to not only be able to construct surveys, understand how to do that, you need a real understanding probably of statistics and how to analyze
Correct.
Data and mathematics.
And with psychometrics, there are concerns about reliability, the consistency of measurement. Ask somebody a question one day, how depressed are you? Ask them a question the next day. You wouldn't expect a big change. If there's a change in the measurement, that's error. I try to get that error out of there. So measuring psychological variables is really a challenge.
And I can tell, you know, from working with you that studying statistics and trying to glean information is something that you have a passion for.
I enjoy that. I like math.
Well, you've done a lot of work, and you alluded to it, in the field of human sexuality. You serve on the editorial board for the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy. How did you find that specialty?
It found me when I went to Bradley. One of the courses I had to teach was a human sexuality course. I'd never studied human sexuality other than the normal interest of an adolescent boy in sex. Never taken a course in college or graduate school. So I had this course that was part of my teaching load. So a number of faculty now tell me I can't teach an area. I say, yes, you can. You can learn it quickly. So I remember my first day of teaching, met for 3 hours once a week. And I brought in 20 pages of notes. I read through them in about 20 minutes. I said, okay, are there any questions? Luckily, there were no questions. Because someone asked me, like, where did you say the uterus was in the male? I said, well, most males have the uterus on the left side, but occasionally it migrates to the right side. I just sort of made up some answer. No one had questions. I said, see you next week. And went home and told my wife we're leaving. This is a mistake.
You said, I'm packing up my bags.
I'm done. This was crazy. But I worked at it and became better at it. And so that became an area of knowledge of me. My wife moved to Cleveland for her job at Case Western. There's a postdoctoral fellowship in human sexuality. So I did that for 2 years. Worked with people who want to change their genders, people with sexual problems, the top of the law, people whose sexual functioning was disturbed also. So I kind of fell into that area.
So you needed that extra time, and that postdoctoral study really then made the difference for you so you could come back into a teaching position?
Not really. It's more a clinical postdoc. Just as a way to keep myself occupied off the streets and out of trouble for a couple of years. Indiana was not a very clinical psychology program. If you graduated from Indiana, got your PhD, took a clinical job, you see the faculty walk up and down the hall, where did we go wrong?
Sure.
So to do clinical work for 2 years was very good for me.
Well, in fact, as you well know, we have a master's in clinical psychology here.
Correct.
And it's really important. There's a huge need for now. It's amazing post-COVID.
Especially now.
Yeah. So I do want to stick with the idea of human sexuality. You had a famous study back in 2008.
Yes.
And it garnered an awful lot of attention. And
it did.
In fact, it was even mentioned on the David Letterman show. What was the study about?
It was a one-off study. I had the idea of asking sex therapists how long sex should last. It wasn't an area of particular specialty of mine, just as a curiosity. So I got a sample of sex therapists in the United States and Canada, a representative sample. I asked them 4 questions. What is an adequate time for sex last from penis entering the vagina to ejaculation? What's a desirable time? What's too short? The odd one was too long. Mm-hmm. They gave me their answers, and too short was less than 2 minutes in their opinion based on their clinical work. Adequate was 3 to 7 minutes. Desirable was 7 to 13. And too long, they were from 10 to 30 minutes. And this became just a huge, hugely popular article. And my favorite interview of this was some Spanish language television program or radio program in Mexico or Colombia called and brought me on. And I speak no Spanish. So there was a chance the host would speak to the translator. They translate the question to me. I speak back to the translator. They translate to Spanish. And the audience just burst into laughter. I have no idea
what's going on.
So for like 15 minutes, I'd say something, they translate, and they burst into laughter. Can you believe what that crazy gringo is saying?
Well, how many times was the... Do you know how many times it's been cited? How many times it's been in the literature? Any idea?
I've not checked. A lot.
Okay. A lot. Probably thousands is my guess.
Yeah. Newspapers from all and radio stations all over the world. India, Colombia picked it up. It was very, very popular. And David Letterman made fun of it.
So that's your most popular, but there's a difference between your most popular and what you think your best research was. Mm-hmm. So what would you say your best research study was?
I think of two. One was a study of clomipramine, which is a treatment for depression, which has a side effect of delaying ejaculation. Mm-hmm. And we use that to treat rapid ejaculation. And that was, I think, probably my best study. So we took a side effect of a drug and turned around and used it for a therapeutic effect.
Wow.
My second other favorite studies was my nephew, which was a way of calculating the sample size you needed to build a correct confidence interval for your results.
They both sound like in the end they had some practical impact as well.
Yes.
That really made a difference.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, let's go back to teaching and the discussion we were having about teaching. So your first teaching experience was not so great. And I can also recall mine, by the way, which was right over in Turnbull Hall. Not so great either, right? I wouldn't want a video recording of that. But
my favorite thing, my first year of teaching, one of the students in my class wrote on my evaluation, "I think you'll be a good teacher, eventually.
Eventually. He has the interest. Well, fast forward, and you've been recognized as a Penn State teaching fellow. So why don't you tell us, what does it mean to be a teaching fellow? And what's your philosophy? How do you teach?
First of all, it's a great honor to be a teaching fellow. That's Penn State-wide award. There are some 4,000 to 5,000 faculty members at Penn State, I think 6,000 now.
Mm-hmm.
And to be selected out of 6,000 or 4,000 is really quite an honor. I believe in having enjoyment in the classroom, being humorous, and light, but also the challenge of teaching is taking something you know well and finding a way to transmit it to people who don't understand it. And so you know it so well, it's obvious how you get from A to B.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody doesn't know, it's like A to B, isn't there, the 7 intermediate steps? What are they? So you have to take something that you know very well and boil it down to a simpler way or a memorable way or a more complex way that actually tells people how to do it. So that is the challenge.
Do you have any particular examples of how you do that?
Sure. For teaching the normal curve, I had a friend build me a quinconx, which is a device for a little like Plinko machine. Mm-hmm. Balls come down, they form a normal curve. I have this fairly large thing filled with BBs. Have the students guess what shape it's going to make as the balls come down one by one. If you watch them go down one by one, they kind of bounce around on the pegs in a very random pattern. And the student says, "I think it'll be flat. I think it'll be a smiley face. I think it'll be a hill." And so, and it turns out to be more like a hill, more like a normal curve.
Yeah, it turns out to be the what we call Gaussian or normal
yes.
probability distribution. Now, for those in the audience who are wondering, a lot of you might know, but that's what we typically see in nature, so it's used all the time. It's also mathematically neat to use it, and I've seen you run that demonstration. So it's one of those great examples where your intuition completely fools you, and you end up with something very elegant.
You watch when the balls drop down. It's so random. There's no way it's going to form a pattern. It'll be different every time, but it's consistently the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really neat experiment. So let's talk about your teaching over the 29 years. Sometimes we look back and we say, you know, when I was young, things were different, and probably we're fooling ourselves. But what's changed in teaching? Have you seen differences in the students, the approaches to teaching?
I think technology has changed dramatically, and that changes everything. Students are much more screen-based, you know, and much less note-taking-based.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite worst teaching stories of a fellow faculty member was told me that somebody saw a student who couldn't afford the book, eventually could afford a book, and borrowed the book from her neighbor, and just took what the neighbor had highlighted and highlighted the same thing in her book.
Jeez.
And that's not exactly the way to study.
Imitation.
So you have to process this material and think about it yourself. So I think our students are much more likely to take a picture of the screen, their phone, or the teacher writes on the board. And teachers are much more less likely to write on the board these days, much more likely to have PowerPoint slides. So I think you lose that kind of step-by-step going through things, working it out.
There's a lot of research that shows, even, you know, if we're in a meeting or you're sitting in a classroom, that writing on a paper or something approximating paper makes a big difference in the way we learn.
Correct.
And you just don't get that by looking at something and typing it into a computer.
I think typing in, you probably do get some of that, but I think just taking pictures of it.
You don't.
You don't.
Yeah. So when you look at our psychology program, you know, what are some of the strengths? What do people learn when they're in our psychology program?
I think the most important strengths of our psychology program is a focus on doing research.
Mm-hmm.
Students have three research courses they take in a row, a stats course, basic research methods, and advanced research methods. In the process of that, they carry out their own study. So learning how to do science is actually the best way to learn science, best way to learn the content of an area. I think that's probably our biggest strength. I tell potential students, so Penn State has different psychology programs at different campuses. Ours is the best. It's also the hardest, but it's the best here at Behrend.
You know, what I love seeing is, you're right, that it's really research-based. And you can see it when you walk through the halls and you interact with the faculty and you go into the labs. You know, the work is highlighted prominently in the hallways on poster boards. Your faculty and your students go to conferences. I think you probably, and I always say, the psychology program here is probably the best at getting undergraduate research funds, and I mean that truly as a compliment.
Yes.
That means the students are engaged.
We take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
And we take the money.
Yeah, absolutely should. And, you've got some nice labs, and you get some great work out of it. So how about topic-wise, what are the things that different areas that a student comes here, what do they get to study? Do they get choice in what they're looking at?
Sure. They can. There are possibilities of working with different faculty members who study different things. We have a couple of clinical faculty members who study trauma in particular. It's very popular these days. We don't have a social psychologist these days, a developmental psychologist who study, you know, bullying in high school students and middle school students. We have experimental psychologists studying memory and sarcasm. And then students often have their own ideas, and we support them doing their own research as well.
Lot of important areas. And I mean, that really, if you look at that, it's really grown over into a really well-known research center we have here on campus.
Yes.
Which is the Susan Hurt Hagen Core. So why don't you tell us what that's about and the work that they do and how that evolved?
That started many years ago with Carl Colgren, a faculty member here, who was very interested in preventing teenage pregnancy. And Susan Hurt Hagen donated a fair chunk of money to support his work in that. Has grown to help positive youth development and mentoring programs where they do work in the community and schools and community schools to help students grow as well as they can, get adults involved in mentoring the students, and giving them role models, and basically trying to have our youth grow in as positive way as they can, giving them as good a life as they can. Really tremendously important work. And in Union City, they, a couple years ago, did a study and dramatically reduce the truancy rate and the dropout rate in Union City just by doing mentoring. So it's a phenomenal program.
Yeah, the impact they have is, it's always amazing to see from when they started on teen pregnancy and the teen pregnancy rates dropped, like you said, impact on truancy, and now they're working a lot more with the urban school districts.
Yes.
So not only are you, of course, we're talking a lot about psychology, but the School of Humanities and Social Sciences encompasses a lot of different academic disciplines. Why don't you tell us about some of them, and why should a student or somebody study one of your majors in the School of Humanities?
Because we're the most interesting school in the college.
All right.
Okay. We have 9 different majors you can have. 3 of them are kind of traditional majors, psychology, English, and history, poli-sci, so I'm assuming 4 of them. 2 of them were developed here, Digit, National Arts Administration, used to be developed here. But we have creative writing. We're the only school, only college in Penn State system. You can get a bachelor's degree in creative writing.
Oh, yeah.
We have Digital Arts, Media, and Technology, which is our newest major, which is a fascinating one. It's hard to describe Digit. Best I can do is basically ask the questions that humanities scholars have asked all the time, but now do it in a different format. Answer them with digital materials, video, websites, things like that. So it's a more interactive approach, not writing a book, but producing digital material. The school is kind of, I think, the liberal arts bastion of the college. And I think liberal arts give people a great idea of critical thinking, communication skills, sometimes called soft skills of understanding people. Taking a literature course and reading great books, get an understanding of people you don't get other ways. So even though it doesn't seem that it's pragmatic in some ways, it actually is very pragmatic. You learn some very helpful skills to function on any job. My goal for the students is to be both thinkers and doers, to have the depths of history or poli-sci or psychology or English, but also have some pragmatic applied skills, some coding skills, or language skills or something that's...
Well, so well said. I mean, we're in a world where popular culture sometimes just wants to devalue a higher education degree into where can you get a job afterwards.
Correct.
And no, that's important, and I talk about that quite a bit. But the thing that distinguishes a college degree, a Penn State degree, is every student who graduates from this university or from Penn State Barron will go through your School of Humanities and Social Sciences.
There are several courses, a communication course, public speaking course, 2 English courses, and other courses as well. There's actually a study done a couple of years ago looking at students 10 years after college and looking at their salaries and compared academic majors like history and psychology and English to more applied majors like engineering and business. And there was not much of a difference in salaries after 10 years after college, maybe $3,000 or $4,000 higher for the engineers and the business people, but that's not that for 60 versus 63.
Not that big a difference.
And interestingly, both groups are equally happy with their careers, which is important. Find something you want to do and do that. It's just as important as making a lot of money. So the students in HNSS, Humanities and Social Sciences, tend to want more, have more of an impact on the world.
Yeah.
So I tell the students to come here and learn something that will help you be a leader, help you make changes in the world.
Yeah, and one of the things, you also talked about the idea of where else would you read about great works of literature and philosophical thought and figures in history. And I will tell you, those things have always intrigued me, and they were a part of my college career. And they really do make a difference in where you go. In fact, they're the things that matter more because you're dealing with people all the time.
Correct. And literature is a great way to learn about people.
Well, let's switch to a few of your, I'll call them pet projects.
Okay.
And I say pet in a nice way, in a good way. You've always, you always come to me. One of the things is, Eric, you show up in my office or you call me and say, hey, I got an idea. I'm like, go ahead. Some of them have been a little off the wall.
Several of them have been.
And some of them have really been off the wall and come to fruition in a good way. So I think we can joke about that. But one that you were passionate about is this idea of the color walk. What was a color walk?
Color walk was, there's a grant from Penn State to put more sculpture around the campuses. And I believe very strongly in having art on campus. I love art. It just lifts me up to see art. So there's more art in the Cockle building now than there used to be. And the color walk was a joint project with us in the School of Engineering, plastics technology, to be specific, where we got a grant to bring an artist in from Cleveland who developed these discs of different colors, different shades of pink, that she stacked on iron rods and hammered into the ground and kind of wove his way through some trees. And the engineering students were involved in the production of the discs. Had a great time. For them, it kind of blew their mind that she said, I don't want the same color every time. It can be different colors. There's color variation, that's great. You sure? It shouldn't be the same color every time? No. Throw some other colors in there. I don't care. So it kind of got them out of their very linear thinking. And they enjoyed doing that. And the arts administration people enjoyed, setting it up and helping to build it. It was up for about a year, 9 months. It looked very nice in the snow and the leaves and different times. Just kind of meander through it and reflect.
What was the reaction people had?
I think people were a little perplexed by it when it first went up. We got a sign up to explain what it was. People were, what the hell is this? But it was kind of a little break from the day. Just kind of go into the copse of trees and walk through there and meander and just take a 30-second break and see some colors you don't see in nature.
Yeah, it was a great addition, and it made people think, to your point, what is that? Yeah. Why is it there? Where did it come from? So they got to ask questions.
This is art?
That's right.
Yeah.
It takes all forms.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about another one of your projects, something called the Mirror Project.
Okay.
Now, this is a great idea. I didn't say, hey, what's that one? It's a great idea. You've got a lot of passion. Let's hear about the Mirror Project.
The Mirror Project grew out of one of my favorite podcasts by, block his name.
Malcolm Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell had a podcast about the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. The result of the decision was that schools were integrated, but they had closed several schools in the South. The schools that closed were the black schools, and the black teachers were thrown out of work. It had a huge impact on black unemployment and black middle class, but also a huge impact on the future of black students.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a student doesn't have a teacher who looks like him or like her, it's harder for that student to succeed. And so there have been studies, for example, trying to figure out why fewer black students are in gifted programs than white students. It's not intelligence, it's not social economic status, it's whether you have a black teacher or not. A student, black student with a black teacher is much more likely to be nominated for a gifted program than one who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So in Erie, about 34% of the students in the public schools are black, only 3% of the teachers are black. There's only a 10% chance of having a black teacher in elementary school. So we have hundreds of students, thousands over time, who go through school and never have any teachers who look like them. So I call this the Mirror Project. I want to build a population of teachers who mirror the population of students. And so we're trying to raise money for an endowment to give a student from the area of public schools a full tuition for 4 years at Behrend to be an education major and go back to Erie and teach school. And over time, this is a slow project. Over time, the number of students of black teachers will grow, or teachers who are Muslim or from any other immigrant community will grow, and the boats in the area will rise. More students will graduate from high school, go on to college, and economically the area will thrive eventually.
Well, you've got, I'm going to put you on the spot if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
I mean, you have, you've made a generous donation yourself.
I have. I have two donations. I have a $400,000 estate gift I've made to the Mirror Project. And I also have challenged the council fellows and anybody else. I'm asking them 50 cents on the dollar for every contribution they make to the Mirror Project. So far, someone has contributed $100,000. I've contributed $50,000. I'm going to do that up to $167,000, which would be $500,000 total. So
that's a wow.
Yeah, so I have 127 still to go, 117 still to go.
And I think we'll get there. If anyone's interested, call us.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
Donate now.
Well, let's talk about I'm going to switch subjects on you. You have Parkinson's.
I do have Parkinson's.
And you've had it for quite some time. In fact, before you became school director.
I've had it for about 11 years, was first diagnosed. And it was not entirely a surprise when I was diagnosed. I've been having some trouble with my hands shaking. My typing was deteriorating. my voice was getting quieter and quieter. I went to see a speech person, ENT. She asked me, is your handwriting always been this small? Which is also a sign of Parkinson's. I said, yeah, it's always been pretty small. She says, I think you should see a neurologist. So I went to see a neurologist, and he had me do this thing where you circle your hands in a cycle, your left hand one direction and right hand the other. I looked down, and my left hand was steady, and my right hand was moving around. I was not aware of that. This is not good. He goes, you're right, that's not good. So I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and I always tell people, it affected mostly my typing and my talking, two things a college professor does not need.
So, the two things you really need.
The two things you really do need.
But you've managed, and you've stayed in the classroom.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But the thing is, I'd probably not be retiring now without Parkinson's. I probably have a few more years left.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the time for me to exit gracefully. I still have some voice and I still represent the school. It's harder and harder to do that, though. So that's kind of motivated my decision to retire now.
Wow. It's completely understandable. We appreciate all the contributions you've made as a teacher and as an administrator. Now, before we finish up, I have to hit one more subject with you, which is there's a very persuasive, if I may say, book that is very influential, not that you wrote, that someone else did, that you always recommend everyone else read and understand. Could you tell us about that one?
It's called Influence by Bob Cialdini. And Ralph, I have a present for you.
Ah.
Rebecca Shaw, I'm handing Ralph the fifth edition of Bob Cialdini's book, Influence. And Ralph, can you open the cover, read the inside cover?
Okay, I will open it. I was going to say, I did buy a copy.
Too late.
And read it. When you recommended this to me 5 years ago, but it says, Ralph, please follow Eric's advice and read this book. He's rarely wrong. Cordially, Bob Cialdini. Oh, my God.
Yes.
You had him. You know him personally.
Yes.
I thought this was your writing.
No, this is Bob Cialdini.
What a nice gift. Thank you.
Sure. I think it's the best book in psychology ever written.
Yeah. Could you give people an example of what's it about in a nutshell?
Influence, how to get people to say yes, basically. And you could just use how to manipulate people. But I think you want people to say yes to your projects. And he has six simple ideas. One is, for example, reciprocity. I've given you something, now you owe me something. There's mm-hmm. a debt. And so reciprocity is a way to kind of work on that. There's liking. There's a famous car salesman, Joe, I forget his last name, every year sent to all his customers, I like you, Joe Smith. Send them cars, I like you. And they came back and bought cars from him year after year because he likes you, he likes me. I like Joe too.
Yep.
And so it's a fascinating book.
It's, and to your point, influence, and people may think of it as, in a negative viewpoint, but it isn't at all. We're humans. We have to work together. We have to get things done. And that's the way you do it, is by influencing others.
You want to influence people to get vaccinated these days, to get booster shots. Influence is important.
You know, as we come to a close here, tell me, what do you think, what's the thing you're proudest of in HNSS or here at Behrend? You get the last word.
I'm very proud that we've had seven fairly quiet years in HSS, that it's been a more coherent, cohesive group of people.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked together to develop a strategic plan that I think is a good strategic plan for the school. And we've put art in the building. I'm proud of art in the building also. I think the school has a bright future. We have many dynamic young faculty members who are doing great work. And I think we leave it in good hands. I'm sure we'll pick something good to take over and lead us into the future and get more office space.
Yeah, we will. Well, it's a great ending, and you've had a tremendous career here and a tremendous impact. It's not over yet, but we'll celebrate. Four more months. Well, my guest today is Dr. Eric Cordy, the director of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, also a professor of psychology, Penn State Teaching Fellow. I'm Dr. Ralph Ford. You've been listening to Behrend Talks.